Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome everyone to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm excited to be here. I'll serve as your moderator. Tonight, joining us is my friend and former colleague, Congressman Adam Schiff, who represents California's 28th Congressional District. Congressman Schiff has been a representative in the Congress since 2001. He's the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee and is an outspoken critic of President Trump. As the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Schiff is on the front lines, leading the fight against Russian aggression and defending our democracy both at home and abroad. He'll be discussing Russia, the controversial Nunes memo, and more tonight. And we can't wait to get into it. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming my friend, Congressman Adam Schiff, to the Commonwealth Club. Adam.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to all of you and to the Commonwealth Club and to my good friend Ellen. I'm just delighted to be here. So, where to begin? I know what you're thinking. He doesn't look that little. I never considered myself little, but I never considered myself a leaking monster of no control either. Which kind of conjures up images of an incontinent Frankenstein. At least it does for me. But I'm really delighted to be with you and have a chance to talk about what's going on. And it really is difficult to know where to begin. And, of course, where you might begin today, you would begin a different place a week ago or a month ago. We're all living dog years. Every week seems like seven. Every year seems like a lifetime. But let me just start with the most recent development. And then I want to talk about why we should care about this. Why should anybody care? What is the Russia business all about anyway? But let's look at the week's big development, this 37-page indictment by Bob Mueller. What was so striking to me when I read it was just the incredible level of detail that Bob Mueller was willing to share. This was the product, undoubtedly, not alone of a lot of hard work by Bob Mueller, by the intelligence community, but also a negotiation with the intelligence community. Because whenever you reveal that kind of detail about how you know what you know, you're telling your adversaries a great deal. The Russians undoubtedly had the reaction when this was published, how the hell do the Americans know all that? And they must have immediately begun the process of reverse engineering to try to figure out how could they know all of this. So the intelligence community and Bob Mueller had to conclude that the value of the public knowing this, the value of the Russians knowing this, outweighed any concern over sources and methods. I think it's the right decision. Because this very detailed explanation of how the Russians engaged in research and development and dispatched operatives to the United States to study our political system, to identify the fissures in our society, how they went about developing their budget, who had what roles at this Internet Research Agency, even in communications between one of their staff and a family member in which they say, okay, I had a really rotten day. I had to cover up all of what we're doing. This, I think, is a great education for all of us to see just what lengths the Russians were willing to go to try to intervene in our affairs, and just how cynical an effort it was, how they sought to exploit these divisions within our society. You know, there are a lot of different narratives about what the Russia investigation is about. Of course, the president's narrative is it's all a hoax. This made it very difficult to maintain the hoax narrative because there's 37 pages that say this is deathly serious. This is all too real. Now, the president claims that this somehow vindicates him. Of course, Whenever anyone says hello, he feels vindicated. This is, after all, someone who went to his first meeting with Putin. This is our great negotiator, our president, who goes into his first meeting with Putin, and what does he do? He asks Putin, did you do it? And lest we be cynical about whether we can expect the truth from this former KGB operative, he comes back home and he says, don't worry, I not only asked Putin if he did it, I asked him twice. Apparently not even the most hardened KGB operative can lie more than once in a row. So this is hardly a vindication of that claim that this is all a hoax. Is it vindication that there was no collusion? No, it's not vindication of that either. One thing that's very important to recognize about this indictment is it only concerns one facet of the Russian active measures campaign, their use of social media to organize, to advertise, to get people to conduct rallies against Hillary Clinton, to get people to dress up in a prison outfit and pretend they're Hillary and appear in a cage. The establishment of web pages like Heart of Texas that feigned a real kind of Texas motif, don't mess with Texas, with a very anti-immigrant kind of a message that had more followers than the Texas Republican Party webpage. So it showed what they did on social media. There's no discussion in this indictment of one of the other facets of the active measures campaign, and that is how the Russians hacked into our democratic institutions and began publishing, sometimes on a daily basis, these stolen emails designed to put Hillary Clinton on the defensive. Now, why isn't that discussed in the indictment? Well, Bob Mueller had a reason. He's a very good prosecutor. He's got a very good team. He had a reason not to include that in the indictment. You could see if you wanted to include all of it together, it would be a natural part of the same story. But it is in connection with the hacking and the dumping of documents where the allegations of collusion are most weighty. And I think it's telling that this is not a part of this indictment. And I think that's for a reason. Now, I can't tell you where Bob Mueller will end up on the issue of collusion any more than I can tell you where we will end up on the issue of collusion. But I can tell you a few things that we already see in the public domain. We see, beginning in April of the election year, the Russians making outreach to one of only a handful of Trump foreign policy advisors, George Papadopoulos. And what do they tell Papadopoulos in April of 2016? They tell him, we are in possession of stolen DNC or Clinton emails. Now, the timing of this is very significant. This is even before the Clinton campaign is aware the Russians possess her stolen emails, the Trump campaign is made aware of it. They want to have a relationship with the campaign, and the campaign is made aware they're in possession of stolen Democratic Party emails. It's only a matter of weeks later that the Russians make another approach to the Trump campaign, this time at the very highest levels. Through Aras Agalarov, an oligarch close to Putin, they communicate to the Trump campaign they would like a meeting. They're going to send an attorney, a Russian government attorney, all the way out from Moscow, and they're offering dirt on Hillary Clinton. Now, Papadopoulos knows they have dirt on Hillary Clinton in the form of these emails. So here's another approach to the highest levels of the campaign, offering dirt on Hillary Clinton. So what's the Trump campaign response to this? We would love it. We would love to have your help. And by the way, the best timing is in late summer. Now, that meeting takes place in June of the election year, a secret meeting in Trump Tower with the president's son and his son-in-law and the campaign manager. And the message that goes back from that meeting to the Russians is, we would love to have your help, but we're deeply disappointed in what you gave us at this meeting. This stuff you gave us about the Ziff brothers and money, you know, we want better than that. It's only days later that Julian Assange announces for the first time he has received stolen Democratic Party emails, which we now know came from the Russians. So these are parts of the picture that we can already see. There is undoubtedly more that Bob Mueller can see. There is more that I can't describe. But what's in the public domain already is enough to earn the condemnation of the country for how that campaign behaved. And one of the reasons I use the word collusion instead of the legal term of conspiracy to violate the election laws, and by the way, if you're wondering how conspiracy would be charged, you can see it in this indictment. The indictment charges a conspiracy to defraud the United States by impeding the functions of our agencies that protect us against foreign interference. But the reason I use the word collusion is the bar shouldn't be set so low as to only discuss what is a violation of the criminal law of the United States. It ought to be enough for all of us to condemn the fact that a presidential campaign was only too willing and too eager to accept the support and help of a hostile foreign power. That must never be allowed to happen again. Now, let me mention briefly why you should care about any of this, and then I look forward to our discussion tonight. What is this really about? Was this a one-off designed to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, or was there more involved in what the Russians were doing? It's certainly true that the Russians had a preference in candidates, and you can see that in the indictment. You can see that in the advertising that they took out. You can see that not only in the social media campaign, which was surreptitious, but set out in this indictment, but you can also see it in their overt media. RT, Russia Today, and Sputnik, their paid Kremlin propaganda arms, were pushing out content during the election. The tweets pushing out stories that RT wanted you to see during the election were Hillary Clinton's failing health, the four times the Clintons were almost indicted. These were the stories they were pushing out overtly, even while they were pushing out covertly through social media. And while they were doing that overtly and covertly, they were also hacking democratic institutions and publishing emails and maybe more that is under investigation. Now, they had a preference for Donald Trump for a lot of obvious reasons. This was someone denigrating NATO, someone encouraging Brexit and the further weakening of Europe, someone who would do away with sanctions over Russia's invasion of its neighbor. Who would have imagined in this century we would see a power remake the map of Europe by dint of military force? So they had every reason to prefer Trump. They had every reason not to want Hillary Clinton, someone who spoke out as Secretary of State over the fraud in the Russian elections, someone Putin believed was one of the hidden hands behind the color revolutions, the revolution in Ukraine and elsewhere. But far more fundamentally, what the Russians were after, are after, will be after, is undermining our very democracy, sowing discord in the United States, turning Americans against other Americans, and not just attacking democracy here, but attacking it all over the world. What the Russians did here was unique for us because it was so unprecedented in scale and scope. It's not unprecedented in terms of what the Russians have been doing elsewhere. They are attacking the very idea of liberal democracy. And we need to be aware that autocracy is on the rise around the world. The example that Putin is setting has many imitators. You see it in the rise of authoritarianism in Hungary and in Poland. You see it in the Philippines with Duterte. You see it with Erdogan in Turkey. Turkey is now the leading jailer of journalists in the world. We have lived, all of us in this room, at a time when freedoms around the world were ever increasing. More people living with a free press, more people living in free society, more people able to speak as they will, associate with whom they would, or love whom they would. And I think we grew to think that this was somehow inexorable. In Martin Luther King's expression, that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Only to find that at the moment it is not bending towards justice. And there is nothing immutable about this. In fact, we may be at an inflection point where we cannot say with confidence that more people will live in free society next year, with even less confidence about how the world will look for our children or grandchildren. And I think that calls upon all of us to be the champions of democracy. As long as we have someone in the Oval Office who is not, it is incumbent on all of us to step into the void, to speak out, to be the champions of democracy around the world. Because people still look to us from every corner of the globe. There is nowhere else to turn. The people who are the victims of this campaign of killing in the Philippines, they look to us. The people that gathered in Tahrir Square before they were put in jail or under threat of jail, they look to us. The journalists in Turkey who are in jail look to us. People, freedom-loving people all around the world, they look to us, and increasingly, they don't recognize what they see in the Oval Office. Tonight, I hope we'll have time to talk about what people can do about it. One of the most frequent questions that I get is, what do we do about this? What can we do about this? There is a lot that we can do, and I think this is a moment when the country really needs us, every one of us, in our public life, in our private life, in our corporate life, in our civic life. There is a role for all of us to play right now. I made a statement a couple months ago I thought completely unremarkable, and I was surprised when it got any attention at all. And that is, I said that I think the threat to our democracy from without, that is from Russia and others, is less now than the threat from within. In the denigration of our press, in the belittling of our judges, in the breaking down of the barrier of independence between the White House and the Justice Department, in innumerable ways, our system of checks and balances is being taken apart brick by brick. And it's incumbent on all of us to fight back against this. As long as we are forced to suffer this administration, we all have a responsibility. I'm proud to do my part, and I'm proud to be with you here tonight. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, Adam, can I tell you how proud I am of you? I always knew you'd be
yes,
doing everything you could.
Thank you, and please take as long as you like.
I'm glad to find out that you've found something to do to keep you off the street. Adam and I were just in Munich for the Munich Security Conference. Adam's brother's here, and it's his birthday today. Happy birthday. So let's get right to it. The Nunes memo. Yeah. The minority memo. What is the status of the minority memo? And once the redactions are done, does it have to go back to the White House? Can you release it? What do you think is the status of the memo?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the Nunes memo, our chairman said, was phase one. I think in reality, it's phase two. Phase one took place in March of last year when the chairman held a press conference at the White House and claimed to have received evidence from a secret source of an unmasking conspiracy during the Obama administration targeting the Trump campaign. We would learn soon thereafter that the secret source was the White House. So he was going to the White House to present to the White House information he'd gotten from the White House, and it didn't show any kind of unmasking conspiracy. That was phase one. This memo was phase two. But it was of a very similar kind in that it was an effort to attack the FBI, attack the intelligence community, and indirectly attack Bob Mueller. The rule that they used, an obscure House rule that allows the publication of classified information, has never been used before for good reason. It's not intended to be a partisan vehicle to cherry-pick information, but that's how they used it. Now, the FBI and the Justice Department warned against it, said this was extraordinarily reckless, don't do it, it's misleading and inaccurate. And the president says, I'm releasing it, sight unseen. 100%, he says. And so he did, without a single redaction, correction, or anything like it. We put together a memo that contained the very material facts that the Republican memo left out. But the president doesn't want to release that. And And so we are negotiating with the FBI. I think we're almost concluded, and they've been operating with us in good faith. What we want to do is identify any small subset of the memo that could reveal sources or methods. And we gave them our memo well before we even took it up in committee because we wanted their input. I think we'll resolve that very shortly, and we can put the memo out. It hopefully won't be necessary to go back to the White House, but I do want to make sure that we have visibility into any concern the FBI has, as opposed to a political redaction that the White House wants to make.
Right. So do you think that could be in the next few weeks when you come back from the recess?
I actually hope that we'll do that in the next few days. So it's my goal to have this out this week.
Breaking news. There are a number of questions about Russia, but I know that you also have responsibility and oversight over the entire intelligence community, and that includes North Korea, Iran, many of the other things that are going on that are hotspots. Do you want to talk to us briefly about where you think we are with North Korea?
Sure. North Korea is a very difficult national security problem, or it would have been resolved by prior administrations. But there are things that we can do that could put us on a path to resolving this without military conflict. In my view, China is the key. China doesn't have complete control over North Korea, but it has more influence than any other nation. The red line for China is not a concern, as you often hear expressed, about a collapse of the regime and hundreds of thousands of refugees. China can deal with that.
Right.
What China can't deal with is a unified peninsula that effectively brings American troops to its border, a pro-Western unified Korea. So the question is, what could China do short of that if they're given the right incentive? And the answer is a hell of a lot more than they're doing now. To restrict the North, to constrain the North, to help change the incentives for the North. And I think the way that we get China to do that is not by badgering China, not by tweeting either nice things or insulting things about President Xi, but rather discussing privately with China, look, you say you can't do more to control your client. We hope that's not the case because these are the steps that we're going to have to take to protect ourselves. We're going to have to dramatically expand theater missile defense. We're going to have to impose secondary sanctions on financial institutions, which are primarily Chinese banks. We're going to have to dramatically expand our naval presence in the region. These are all things, and there are others besides that the Chinese do not want to see happen, that give them a reason to do a lot more. But we, first of all, need to all be on the same page internally. We can't have the president saying one thing, the vice president another, the secretary of state a third, our UN ambassador a fourth. We can't be on a different page than our allies, the Japanese, the South Koreans, and others, if we're to have any hope of a successful strategy. There is no good military option. And we need to be doing everything possible to make sure that that's not where we end up. And right now, I'm deeply concerned that is not what the administration is doing. It may not be what the administration is capable of. Even under the best of circumstances, it still may not be enough. But it may be enough. And we owe it to ourselves and our allies to do our best.
So perhaps putting an ambassador in the Republic of Korea, South Korea, would be a good idea.
You know, that would be a good idea. That would be a good idea. And, of course, that calls up a whole other problem.
Yes.
The hollowing out of the State Department. I'll tell you the experience that three of my constituents had a few months ago. They went back to the State Department. They told me that the lights are literally going out in the building at Foggy Bottom because some are on a motion detector. There's not enough motion in the building. The bigger problem was who they ended up meeting with, one of the high-level appointees, one of the few appointees of this president. They sat down, and apropos of nothing, because this was not the subject of the meeting, the high-level person at the State Department began the meeting by saying, "This is a godless building. This is a godless building, and I'm here to change that." And throughout the conversation, every time she refers to Muslims, she called them Muslims, as in a moose. Her chief of staff leaned over to my constituents and said, "This is our code. This is what we call them." So this appointee whose charge has something to do with religious freedom is a bigot. Mm-hmm. And this is who the administration is placing in these high-level posts while they leave others vacant. And this gets obscured because in the wake of all these other crises, we don't see what's happening in so many of our departments. But when you undermine our diplomatic tools, that only leaves the military option. And this is a profound danger.
And as General Mattis says, if you don't increase money for diplomacy and the effort of diplomacy, you're going to have to buy me more bullets. So I think, if for my case, there's no replacement for the Undersecretary for Arms Control at a time when nuclear weapons and certainly the North Koreans and the Iran deal are things that we really need expertise on. A lot of the people in that worked for me, I had 600 people, they've left the building. The building at Foggy Bottom, the State Department, does look like a neutron bomb hit it. The building is there, but there are very, very few people. It's just terrible. Let's talk a little bit about people in the White House without permanent security clearances. It's shocking. It's frightening. It's unsustainable and, frankly, treasonous. But what can we do? What can the Congress do to force the administration? Apparently, there was a news, something from the White House press office today saying that regardless of whether he gets a permanent clearance or not, Jared Kushner is going to stay in his job. As far as I know, he's the only one in the White House that reads the presidential daily briefing, because we know the president doesn't read it. Before that, it was Rob Porter, for God's sakes. What can the Congress do to force the administration to hold the standards on the classification of documents and make sure that people without permanent clearances aren't reading them?
Well, it's very difficult, particularly in the minority. What we ought to be doing is we ought to be hauling them before committees in Congress, right, and shedding a spotlight on it. And frankly, there are so many other areas where we ought to be doing the same thing. But with the current majority, that just isn't happening. I can tell you this, Jared Kushner would never be considered for a security clearance if his father-in-law wasn't the president of the United States.
Right.
There's just no way.
Or a job.
Or well, there might be some job, but not the one that
he's
got.
Not in the White House.
Yes, well, I'm sure the Middle East, you know, will be figured out by Jared Kushner. But, I mean, this is someone who is alleged to have had a secret meeting with the Russian ambassador where they discussed setting up a private back channel communication through a Russian diplomatic facility.
Right.
Now, if that's true, he should never get a clearance.
Right.
Can you imagine if that were true of you or I and we were seeking a clearance? It would never happen. But here's another problem. General Kelly, at the time that story broke, went on the Sunday shows to say, there's nothing wrong with that. Back channels are perfectly appropriate. Sometimes they're desirable. That's nonsense.
Right.
It's one thing when you have the actual government engaging in a back channel discussion,
right,
over a hostage release or whatnot, where there's a need for confidentiality. It's another when you have non-governmental actors meeting secretly with an adversary and using the adversary's facilities.
Right.
There
well,
is
he
no
asked. He
legitimate
asked,
explanation for that unless you're
no.
hiding it from your own government.
Well, he asked Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, how do we do this so that nobody can hear us? How do you facilitate it so that nobody can hear us? As opposed to, we want to have a channel where we're doing high-level conversations, but I'm coming back to talk to my boss, you're talking to your boss. It was really to protect whatever they were doing, just like they thought they had at Trump Tower.
Well, you know, it certainly appears, if the allegations are accurate, that that's exactly right, that this was not designed to further the interests of the country, but they had something they wanted to communicate without their own government, our own government, knowing about it.
Right.
That's not the stuff of a top security clearance. And there's one thing, you know, one of two possibilities about what's going on in the White House right now and has been for quite some time. Given that so many people have been operating under temporary clearances, and that is either these folks are getting access to material that they shouldn't be seeing, or they're not getting access to it and not able to do their jobs the way we need them to do.
Right.
There's a reason you get these briefings, and it's because you're advising the president.
Right.
And you want to be able to give the president the advantage of the very best intelligence the world has to offer, which is, frankly, the intelligence produced by our agencies.
Right.
So it's a problem either way. But if you have a chief of staff who's protecting his own people or defending the indefensible, then that's not something that you can rely on. And unfortunately, the Government Reform Committee, which really ought to be having hearings on this, is not.
Right.
The chairman of that committee has said that on many of these issues, he doesn't believe it's the charter of that committee to investigate something that could potentially be criminal. Well, all of this could potentially be criminal.
But Benghazi was part of it,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Well, there's a very different standard now, apparently.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Yes, well, so Bob Mueller has put together a sterling team of people from the FBI, from U.S. attorneys' offices. Some of them, allegedly, are from the Southern District of New York. And many of them are white-collar crime experts. In the end, it's usually about the money. What do you think is going forward on the whole question of money laundering being the ultimate sin and the instigation for many of the activities that obfuscate what's going on in the White House?
Well, from you know my days as an assistant district attorney in Los Angeles, you know, we follow the maxim of follow the money in white-collar cases. It was a pretty darn good rule, follow the money. There are credible allegations of money laundering. The president's own sons talked about how disproportionate the amount of money they got from Russia was. The only bank that seemed willing to give the Trump Organization massive loans was Deutsche Bank,
right,
which recently paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fines. To the state of New York for what? Money laundering in connection with where? Russia.
Russia.
So this is, I think, one of many credible allegations that should be investigated. When we started our investigation, the allegation of private meetings between the Trump campaign people and the Russians was merely an allegation.
Right.
It proved all too true.
Right.
And from my point of view, what we ought to be most concerned about is any allegation that has the potential, if true, of being a lever over the President of the United States. And, you know, when people think about what the Russians call kompromat, they tend to think about the salacious video mentioned in the dossier. Well, to a president who easily weathers the Stormy Daniels storm and the Playboy model storm, a videotape, if it exists, just isn't that compromising.
Right.
What would be compromising, frankly, far more compromising, is if the Trump Organization was knowingly laundering money for the Russians.
That's right.
And that could be a very powerful lever that could explain the rather inexplicable conduct of the president, his incapacity to criticize Putin, to acknowledge the plain truth that all of his cabinet and everyone else has acknowledged. So that needs to be investigated. We are really hamstrung on our committee. We subpoenaed Fusion GPS's bank records. That was the outfit that hired Christopher Steele. But we won't subpoena Deutsche Bank's records. I think it's very important that Bob Mueller be allowed to investigate this.
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly arises from the Russ investigation. The indictments of Manafort and Gates dealt with money laundering vis-a-vis Ukraine, but that arose also from the Russia investigation. So it's clearly within his scope. But I am concerned that that the president may try to fire Rod Rosenstein
right,
as a way of giving Bob Mueller a new boss someone that can tell Bob Mueller privately, you will not look at money laundering. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know what instructions Rod Rosenstein is giving Bob Mueller now. And we wouldn't know what instructions his successor would be giving. This would be hidden from the public eye, which is one of the reasons why I would consider the act of firing either Rosenstein or Mueller to be an obstruction of justice.
That's amazing. We have some great questions from our viewing audience, both here and on the internet. So one of our people is asking, why might it be better not to pursue impeachment, even assuming Donald Trump is unfit for office? Why? Well, first of all, you need the House and the Senate to be willing to become a grand jury and a jury, and they apparently won't do that now with the majority. What do you think about if we took the House back in November? What do you think the circumstances are about impeachment, and is it possible to even do without having another party control both the House and the Senate?
You know, I really try to discourage my colleagues from talking about impeachment. I have an unusual experience in the House having tried an impeachment case in the Senate about 8 or 10 years ago. We impeached a federal judge out of New Orleans for corruption. I know you're probably thinking, corruption, New Orleans, that's impossible. but it does happen. And we impeached him in the House, and he took us to trial in the Senate. And there were some issues, not of first impression, but of a long time ago impression. One of them was, can you be impeached for conduct that predates your time in office? Because we had impeached him in the House for corruption before he was on the federal bench, for lying during his confirmation, and corruption while he was on the federal bench. We had to look back 150 years to see another case like it. And in the case that was 150 years old, a judge had been impeached on 7 prior counts, 7 post counts, and 1 omnibus count. And that judge had been acquitted on all of the prior counts. And initially, the thought was, well, maybe you can't be impeached for prior conduct. But I asked our staff to dig into the Senate record to find, what did the senators say 150 years ago about their verdict? And the senators who did speak, and they weren't required to, but many did, talked about how they believed you could be impeached for prior conduct, but the evidence on the prior counts was too weak. So it was an evidentiary issue, not a constitutional issue. Long and the short of it is the judge we impeached in the House, we convicted in the Senate on prior counts as well as post. So there's now a very current precedent. You can be removed from office for prior conduct. I wasn't offering that as an applause line, but you could take it as you wish. But the reason I discourage people from pushing impeachment before the investigation is done is it would be an enormously wrenching experience for the country. Right. And what's more, should the evidence warrant impeachment, it will be that much more difficult if people have the view, well, this is what you wanted from the very beginning. Right. This isn't really about removing an unfit president as much as it is about nullifying an election. And the president, whether he does this knowingly and deliberately or just because he is what he is, when he goes to these rallies, he is making the anti-impeachment argument.
That's right.
He is saying, those people who look down on you, those people who think that you're ignorant, they want to take away your great electoral victory. Mm-hmm. He's making the anti-impeachment argument.
Right.
And I think when people talk about it prematurely, when the investigation isn't even concluded, they're only giving fuel to that. Now, what will it require if Mueller comes back or we come back with sufficient evidence? It will require, you know, a very powerful showing with a GOP Congress, but it will require a very powerful showing even in a Democratic Congress.
I agree.
And ultimately, we will have to persuade people, if the evidence is there, that this is necessary to protect the country.
That's right.
This isn't about election nullification. And the conduct is just fundamentally incompatible with office.
That's right.
That's a very high bar.
Well, I agree with you, but even today, you can hear in the commentary on television, except for one station that I don't watch, you can hear the commentators basically arriving at, I think, where many of us have been for a long time, Why isn't the president slightly curious about what the Russians actually did? What is the president doing to investigate what the Russians did, considering we have an election in 7 months in November of 2018 that is just as vulnerable as the 16 election was? And why hasn't the president implemented the sanctions that the House and the Senate voted nearly unanimously for 6 months ago? And I think people are starting to see the oath that we took to defend the Constitution and the American people against enemies, foreign and domestic, that he's not doing it. That he is not doing the things that are important because he's such a malignant narcissist that everything becomes about him, and all he can do is talk about Russia vis-a-vis himself. And he has completely missed the whole point, that this is about a foreign power attacking a pillar of our democracy that is different but not unlike Pearl Harbor. And what I know that we're aligned on this, Adam, but what do we tell people, our friends and neighbors here in California, that are frankly disgusted by the situation? What do we tell them, besides the Mueller investigation and the good work that you're doing, what do we tell them is over the horizon that is going to return a sense that we have a way to get out of this and not risk our entire democracy in the meantime?
Yeah. Well, first of all, sadly, you're exactly right about the president and the administration. It's, I think, palpably clear to the members of his cabinet that if you bring up Russia's intervention in our affairs, if you say we need to deal with this, we need to protect the country, you are challenging his legitimacy. You are earning yourself a one-way ticket out of the administration. Mm-hmm. So there has been no cabinet meeting devoted to what do we do about this. And there isn't going to be.
No.
There isn't going to be. There are things going on to protect our elections infrastructure here in California and in the other states. There is work being done in the Department of Homeland Security. But we do not have the kind of whole-of-government effort to combat this.
Or a commander-in-chief.
Or a commander-in-chief who is willing to have a fireside chat with the American people and say, and it wouldn't be that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, look, the Russians did this. They intervened in our election. And yes, they did it because they wanted to help me, and I despise it. And I'm going to make sure that never happens again. And here's what we're going to do, and here's what we need to do.
Right.
And what's more, I'm going to impose these sanctions that Congress passed because I'm going to send a message to Russia. If you think you're paying a price now, wait till you see the price you pay if you interfere again. Just let us catch you interfering again.
Right.
That ought to be the message. It isn't going to be the message, not from the president. So what do we do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, what do we do about, in many respects, the bigger threat to the country? The Russians can't cause us to distrust our own media. The Russians can't cause us to distrust our own institutions, our FBI, our Department of Justice. The Russians can't turn us against each other. We can only do that to ourselves.
Right.
And so there is a lot for us to do. When my constituents ask me, you know, what do I do? What can I do? I live in California. I'm in a blue state. What can I do? There is a role for every one of us right now. And what I always urge people is decide for yourself what you care the most about right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's no short list here. If you're worried about climate change and the environment, then decide I'm going to use this difference to make a difference on climate change. If you care about the fact that the Department of Justice, which used to be in the business of fighting efforts to disenfranchise minority voting communities, is now intervening in litigation on the side of disenfranchisement, then decide I'm going to do something about that. If you're worried that in a matter of weeks, the Department of Homeland Security may start deporting Dreamers, and you have legal services to offer to your neighborhood legal services to represent Dreamers, figure out a way to make a difference on things you care about. Don't try to do it all. The most paralyzing, demoralizing, dispiriting thing is to just look at the whole array of things the country is facing and decide it's too much.
Right.
I can't do anything. It's too much. I'm just going to turn off the news. I'm going to tune it out. It's too much. We can't afford for people to do that. Now, I'll say one other thing. All of these issues are really important. From my point of view, there is nothing more important than providing a check on this administration like we will have if one house or the other is in the hands of a party, not in the White House. So, I want to say this too, because it's something I always think about when I'm tempted to despair, which I rarely am. And that is, Bill Clinton once said, there's nothing wrong in America that can't be cured by what's right in America. There is an awful lot right in America. We will get through this. We will get through this. And once we do, we will begin the process of mitigating the damage that was done and turning things around and restoring our standing in the world and joining the League of Nations to fight climate change and doing all the things that we are not doing currently. And we'll have our work cut out for us, but it's nothing we can't overcome. We've overcome worse. We've had worse divisions in the country in the past. We've gone to war of those divisions in the past. So we will overcome this. But until we do, we all have a role to play.
That's right.
And it's just incumbent on us to figure out, where can I add the most value right now?
Yeah, that's terrific, Adam. We have a question from a high school student who says, I've been watching other students speaking out against gun regulation. Do you think it is that this will happen with other important issues, so that we have more high school students speaking up, the Parkland students, which I think we all hold in our hearts.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, and I know this is a sentiment broadly shared around the country, I have been so impressed with what these young people who were at that high school have had to say. The extraordinary courage they've demonstrated, I wish that many of my colleagues in Congress had half the courage we're seeing them exhibit. I hope that this is the final straw that breaks the NRA's back.
They've been mysteriously quiet for a week.
You know, there have been other times like this where we have thought after Newtown and other tragedies, okay, surely this will bring about change. And then it hasn't. And it's inexplicable. I think the worst indictment of the Congress that we continue to see mass casualty after mass casualty. Interestingly, the Russians are really big fans of our Second Amendment.
Right.
We see this in their surreptitious social media campaign. They are really glad we have a Second Amendment. They don't particularly want one of their own, but they're more than happy for us to kill each other every day, and sadly we do. The students are talking about a nationwide boycott. I say go for it.
Yes.
Believe me, I'm loath to give my son encouragement to walk out of high school. If that's what it takes to get the attention of state legislators around the country and members of Congress, for teachers and students to walk out, then walk out.
Yeah.
You know, something has got to change. I was talking with my staff director of the Intelligence Committee. I've got a wonderful staff. And he was saying, you know, I wanted to work on this committee because I wanted to protect the country. And every day I come to work and we're looking at the threats we're facing from around the world. And we are doing nothing about this threat at home.
That's right.
It's insane. When you can't, you know, you can't carry a fluid of more than a few ounces on an airplane.
Yeah.
But if you're 19 years old, you can go buy an assault weapon.
And you can't buy a beer.
And you can't buy a beer. And you can't be prohibited, even if you're on the terror watch list, from buying a weapon. It's insane.
Right.
It makes no sense at all. The only way you can explain it is there's a very powerful organization standing in between what the country wants and what it's getting. And until we stand up to that organization, we're going to get more of the same death. I always used to tell my kids that don't worry, it won't happen at your school. And that's what every parent wants to tell their child.
Right.
But how can you in good conscience say that now?
That's right.
I have one in high school and one in college. And high schools and colleges around the country have faced this all too many times. And those young people in Florida right now have every right to pronounce the most harsh indictment of their elected officials, of their parents' generation, for doing nothing while they're at risk.
You know, they took a bus, series of buses from Parkland, the survivors and their classmates today, three or four buses up to Tallahassee, where there was going to be a vote, and the vote failed. And right in front of these kids. And you have to wonder why people don't understand that the National Rifle Association isn't really there to represent people's Second Amendment rights. It represents gun manufacturers.
Yep.
And I was impressed by some of the young people I've seen over the weekend. They get it. They're laser-like in this. They may not have actually thought about it 10 days ago. They might have known a little bit about it, but they have done their homework. And they now understand that we have to shame people into understanding that you cannot have an organization that spent $50 million on the last election. We assume it's American money, by the way, but who knows? Since the Russians like them so much. That is really there to represent manufacturers who have just not even people's good health, because they make things that can be turned into, you know, weapons of mass destruction. So I'm hoping that the Parkland kids can get themselves more national attention, more. But you've seen, as I know happens to you, you've seen that people are going after them now.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, for years I've carried a bill to repeal something Orwellian by the Orwellian name of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. This was a bill that was the NRA's top priority that gave the gun industry an immunity from liability that no other industry enjoys.
Wow.
The alcohol industry doesn't have it. The tobacco industry doesn't have it. No industry has an immunity from liability. The gun industry does.
Right.
And I've been pushing legislation for years now that would repeal that immunity. But you're right. The NRA exists to protect the gun makers, not the public.
No.
It's the manufacturers and the dealers that they care about. You know, one of the things that gives me hope on this, like everything else these days, is the tremendous level of activism around the country that we saw from the very first day after the inauguration, right, when the size of the Women's March dwarfed anything at the inauguration. I don't care what Reince Priebus has to say or Sean Spicer. What we are going to need is the march to end all marches, a march on the polling places.
That's right.
A march on Election Day to the polling places, and to any representative, any party, anywhere in the country who isn't with those students, they ought to be voted the hell out of office.
That's right. So I have a lot of cards that say, would you consider running for president in 2020... with either Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren as a running mate? We don't say who goes where, though, right?
No. and I don't mean that as a critique of those potential running mates. I'm flattered to be asked the question. I had thought about running for the Senate, to be candid, but very early on, made it clear that I was a Senator Feinstein fan, and if she was running, I was not. And I'm glad she's running. I haven't thought about running for anything else. And right now, I'm just trying to right now, I'm just trying to defend myself from presidential tweets. But I am devoting myself quite completely when I'm not doing my day job to taking back the House of Representatives. And the path to doing that runs right through California.
Yes, it does.
So we will have an outsized role to play.
Yes. Yeah, I have a small super PAC that's working on that, too. One more Russian question. Do we know if Russians impacted the actual vote counts or tallies in the swing states like Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, I'm glad that, you asked that question, whoever it was. Thank you for putting that question. Because, not surprisingly, the president likes to conflate two very different things. The intelligence community found that there was no evidence that the Russians had successfully penetrated the voting systems and manipulated the vote count. Now, the president and the vice president, and at times, sadly, even the director of the CIA, has made the false claim that that means there was no effect on the outcome of the election. Right. That was not what the intelligence community found.
Right.
In fact, the intelligence community was very explicit that we make no finding about the impact on the election. Mm-hmm. And they can't. That's well beyond their scope. Now, this election was obviously a very close election. Whether it was determinative or not, I don't think we'll ever be able to say definitively. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's easily measured. But I can tell you one person who thought that the Russian Active Measures campaign was highly influential. And that person is named Donald Trump.
Right.
And I say that because every day on the campaign trail, Donald Trump trumpeted the stolen emails.
Right.
Look what we got today from our friends at WikiLeaks, from our buddy Julian Assange, who earlier the candidate, Trump, said deserved the death penalty.
Right.
But now he was his great chum. So the president, if he was going to devote every campaign stump speech to these stolen emails, clearly thought they were influential with voters.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have evidence of actual manipulation of the vote count. Now, I'll tell you what I fear even more than that. It's what I feared in real time while this was going on. And that is not that they'll get into the machines and change the vote count. That is a worry. That is a concern, and we need to guard against it. And frankly, any voting place that doesn't have a paper trail is negligent.
Right.
But what I fear the most in real time was this. From what we could gather, the documents the Russians dumped were all authentic documents. They didn't dump forgeries. And what I was worried about was that they would take a real document and they would add a new paragraph to it. They would take a document that might be embarrassing and add a paragraph that indicated illegality.
Right.
You can imagine if there were an email that were published in the weeks leading up to the presidential election that suggested that Hillary Clinton was engaged in criminal conduct or the campaign was. That could be profoundly election-altering, and there would be no way for the candidate to rebut
respond,
it,
right.
Particularly when parts of the email could be corroborated because they were authentic.
Right.
That was my fear, and I continue to fear that more than I do tampering with the machines. There is no perfect safeguard to that. There's no cyber fix to that. The Russians are a capable enough actor. If they want to get into the DNC in 2020 or the RNC, they will get in. The only real protection is that when we discover foreign meddling, that we agree that we will not exploit it, that we will reject it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we didn't have that in the last election.
Yeah.
We darn well better have it in the next.
We've reached the point in the program when there's only time for one last question.
Those are always the troublemakers.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think we need a 9/11-like commission to look into what exactly happened in the election, in the fundamental pieces of the election, where you have independent experts that understand election law, they understand that our elections are run by states, but really by counties, and there's a patchwork quilt around the country. Do you think that, you know, if we gave a 9/11 light commission with experts that were independent 6 months to do something, that we could begin to get ourselves ready for the election? Because clearly, whatever's happening at Homeland or someplace else isn't going to be enough.
I think that would be very desirable. Frankly, that would have been the first thing
right.
to do,
yes.
not the last. When this all happened and the election was over and we first began discussing how this should be handled, what I was urging was, along with others, I think yourself included, mm-hmm. was that we establish a 9/11 commission,
right.
something that would be completely outside the political realm,
mm-hmm.
that would be apolitical, that would enjoy the public confidence. There's no commission really in my lifetime that's had the credibility of the 9/11 commission. This was, as you point out, the sort of political equivalent of 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. And in addition to that independent commission, I thought that Congress ought to do a bipartisan, bicameral investigation, right. a House-Senate intelligence investigation.
Right.
Indeed, that's what we did after 9/11. We
okay.
had the 9/11 commission, which was the more famous body. But there was the joint inquiry, which was the House and Senate Intelligence Committees
right.
doing a joint investigation. What you may be familiar from that work product is the 28 pages.
Mm-hmm.
The 28 pages were 28 pages that were recently declassified
right.
that went to the issue, really, frankly, the issue of collusion. Did the Saudi government conspire? Did they participate? Did they have a role in this attack?
Mm-hmm.
Those 28 pages were inconclusive.
Right.
And I know the question that many Americans have right now is, what will be the result of this investigation?
Mm-hmm.
Will it reach a definitive conclusion on that issue, or will it also be inconclusive? What I said from the very beginning of our investigation during our open hearing when we had James Comey testify is that the most profound service we could offer, I didn't know whether we'd be able to get there, and 9 times out of 10 when you bet against Congress, you win. But the biggest service we could offer was a unified conclusion.
That's right.
If we end up offering a Democratic narrative and a Republican narrative and force the country to choose, we will be adding very little value.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, that has proved very difficult.
Right.
I do want to say why I think, even though we've had the difficulties we've had, that our work in Congress is so important, and that is this. It is not Bob Mueller's job to tell the country what happened. It's Bob Mueller's job to figure out, have U.S. laws been violated and who should go to jail? That's his mandate. And he may not be allowed to speak to the country outside of the four corners of an indictment. It falls upon Congress to give the full accounting to the public. Here's what we found. Here's what we found that the Russians did. Here's how they did it. Here's what we found about U.S. person involvement.
Mm-hmm.
These are the facts that we learned, even if we can't agree on what they mean. But here's what we found. Here's what went into that meeting at Trump Tower. Here's what we know about Natalia Veselnitskaya. Here's what we know about these other characters. Here's what we know about the professor. Here's what George Papadopoulos had to say to others in the campaign. Here's what the campaign knew when they went into that meeting in Trump Tower. We should lay it all out for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, we should say this is what we need to protect ourselves going forward. Bob Mueller isn't in a position to do that. We are. And we need to. And I think that means that we need to do a thorough investigation, a credible investigation, in the maximum degree possible, a bipartisan investigation, and we need to level with the American people.
Well, I'm so glad you're there, Congressman Adam Schiff. Let's give our thanks to Congressman Adam Schiff for joining us this evening at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Ellen Tauscher. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Terrific.
Thank you so much.